Hello and welcome to the As Yet Unnamed London Theatre Podcast for the 18th of March 2018. My name's TRP Watson, this time I'm joined by Gareth James and Johnny Fox. We're now going to talk about Caroline or Change at the Hampstead Theatre. This is a production of Tony Kushner and Janine Tesori's musical, sung through musical, directed by Michael Longhurst. This production was previously at the Minerva Theatre in Chichester last year, and they have brought quite a lot of the cast back for this production, principally Sharon D. Clarke, who plays the Caroline of the title. The story is set in 1963, so we get a little bit of Kennedy, and it is about an African-American maid who is working in a Jewish household in the Deep South, where there are decisions being made about taking down a statue of a Confederate general. But it's mostly, I think, about the relationships that Caroline has to this family and also Caroline's own family. Gareth, tell me more about this production and what you thought of it.
Well, I went down to Chichester to see it in the Minerva Theatre last summer because it's a show I've got very fond memories of when it was at the Littleton at the National some time ago now, 10 years, I think. So I pounced as soon as I heard it was transferring and went back to see it at Hampstead Theatre. It is an incredibly original musical. As you say, it's sung through, and it's a kind of domestic story of Caroline and the family she lives with, the Gelmans. But it's also about the civil rights movement and about the sort of two generations. Caroline's generation is fairly reverential, and her daughter's generation are the sort of the people who are leading the civil rights movement and participating in the civil rights movement. The other thing that's original about it is that some of the characters, shall we say, Caroline is the maid in this household. It's actually an autobiographical play, very autobiographical, because in his youth, Tony Kushner lived in Louisiana, and his dad was a wind player, and the dad here is a clarinet player, different instrument, same set of instruments. And Caroline spends all of her time in the basement, which is itself part of the story, because of course in Louisiana the water level is so low that effectively you're underwater in a basement, although not literally. And she does an interminable amount of washing. The washing machine is on all of the time, or the dryer is on all of the time, and as she's working she listens to the radio. And one of the original things about it is that the radio is effectively a character, or rather three characters, because it's represented by a black 60s girl group. The washing machine is a character who has the most fabulous costume, a Suds costume, I'll call it. And the dryer is a character, and is a kind of devil-like character. And later on in the show, we've also got the moon and a bus. So we've got characters who are inanimate objects, but played by actors. Caroline has a very soft spot for the son of the family, Noah, and he indeed for her. Noah has recently lost his mum, and his dad is somewhat lost, and his relationship with his dad isn't very good, and the grandma and grandpa are around, and the mother's, or the stepmother's, father also makes an appearance as well. And there is a stepmother, he married quite hastily, and she's trying hard to form a relationship with Noah, but that's also struggling as well. So we've got the sort of story of this family and their maid, and it does revolve around Caroline the maid, but we've also got the story around the civil rights movement, and it's very prescient because, of course, the issue of statues cropped up again last year in North America, so it's not in any way dated, although the movement is 40 or so years old, or 50 or so years old now. And we also meet Caroline's daughter, and we also meet her friend. So there are other characters who we meet when we leave the basement and go to the bus stop and other places. It is, in addition to original, it's got a very good score, which is a kind of cocktail of jazz and spirituals and 60s pop and all sorts of genre. So it's an excellent score, and that's important as it is sung through. It's incredibly well directed here by Michael Longhurst, who's brought it up to Hampstead from the Minerva. And it's got fantastic designs as well. I think that the show's great achievement, though, is the amazing casting. And most of it is actually has come from Chichester. The three girls who play the radio are all new, and includes Tashawn Williams, who was with Charity Clark in The Life back in last winter, I think, at the Southwark Playhouse, and indeed won an Offie Award, as Charity Clark did for her performance in that. And Sue Calvin's taken over from Beverly Cline as Grandma, and Alistair Brookshaw has taken over from Alex Gomond as the new dad, Stuart. But apart from that, it's the same cast. And of course, it's led by this towering performance by Sharon D. Clarke. I mean, I've seen her lots of times, and I've seen her give lots of fantastic performances, but this must be her finest moment. It's a role that completely suits her, and it's a role she clearly relishes. And it's just beautifully acted, beautifully sung, and the standing ovation that she got at Hampstead on the night I went was absolutely well-deserved, really. Tony Kushner hasn't done another musical. This was something he did with Jane Tesori, and it was just a kind of one-off, really. Obviously, he's best known here for Angels in America, and he did another play, which we've nicknamed Iho, or he nicknamed Iho, at the Hampstead Theatre just a year or two ago. But it's just original, it's a fascinating piece, it's a brilliant revival, it's wonderfully cast, and it has to be seen. And I mentioned the design, but I didn't mention that it was Fly Davis that did the designs, that Nigel Lilly leads the orchestra in this production. So an absolute must-see, and I would be very surprised, given it's virtually sold out its Hampstead run, that if it doesn't transfer into the West End, which would be great, because the original production, The Littleton, which this betters, by the way, didn't transfer, and was only seen by however many were seen when it was in rep at The Littleton. So I can't emphasise enough how important it is that any musical lover goes and sees it.
How does the Hampstead compare to the Minerva in terms of size? Because, of course, the Hampstead is a much more flexible space these days and can accommodate a musical. I mean, obviously, you know, it had rather successful one with Sunny Afternoon, so it can do musicals. But is it comparable to the size of Minerva? Because I've not been in the Minerva.
It's actually smaller. The Minerva is a studio theatre at the side of the Chichester, the main festival theatre in Chichester. So it's a relatively small theatre anyway. But when I got into Hampstead and I looked at it, I realised how much smaller it is than Hampstead Theatre. And that did two things, I think. One, it brought an intimacy, although we were in the Minerva sitting quite far back and I wasn't here, but it certainly felt a more intimate piece. They've created a kind of apron stage and the seating kind of goes round in an arc. So it's kind of three-sided, but in an arc shape. So you're right on top of it if you're in the stalls. And then there's a big backdrop where the band appear in the top left and top right. And then there's a performance area in between them, and the backdrop also can move. So I thought it brought more intimacy because of that. But although in some ways there were moments when it probably felt better in the Minerva being a little bit further away when it was at its kind of, you know, when there were more people on the stage and it was at its most epic. But it is a smaller space than the Minerva, I would guess, probably by as much as 100 seats. I think Hampstead's about 300-ish. And I think the Minerva must be 400 or 500. But it works there anyway. And I shouldn't be a reason for anybody not to go and see it. And it's good to see another musical at Hampstead, even though it's not homegrown. I think Sunday Afternoon was the only homegrown musical that I can remember in the new theatre in Hampstead.
The other thing is, of course, the Hampstead audience, because it is a bit staid. You from the sound of the standing ovation, obviously this is either a slightly different audience or coming for Sharon D. Clarke and the musical itself rather than the more staid Hampstead audience, or did you think it was much the same?
I think it was, there was a fair smattering of the usual Hampstead audience, but there were newer people, younger and newer people that didn't seem to me to be the Hampstead audience. Although the shock to the system is there were only two black people in the audience. And when you're given what the play is all about, that's a bit of a shock. But that isn't a bit of a shock in Hampstead Theatre, which does have this very middle-class white audience. So it would be great to see it getting a much broader and more diverse audience, I have to say.
We're now going to talk about The Best Man at the Playhouse Theatre. This is Gore Vidal's 1960 play, written in the aftermath of the 1960 Democratic National Convention, and is a portrait of a convention in which two Democrat candidates are vying for the approval of various groups, women's groups, and also an old president. So generally when people talk about this play, they say that one presidential candidate is based on Adlai Stevenson and another presidential candidate here is based on JFK, John Kennedy. And they are obviously vying for the ex-president, they're vying for the approval of, is therefore Truman. Gore Vidal didn't particularly like the Kennedys, the Kennedy clan, and did like Adlai Stevenson a lot. So his sympathies are very clearly on one particular side, I think, in this play. And also people say it's not just a portrait of Kennedy, it also mixes in a little bit of Nixon into the mix, because Gore Vidal also hated Nixon just as much. This production is directed by Simon Evans, and as I say, was on tour last year. Pretty much you've got the same cast as last time, with Martin Shaw, Jeff Fahey, Jack Shepherd, Honeysuckle Weeks, Glynis Barber, and then we have Maureen Lipman, who's coming in and replacing Gemma Jones, who was on tour with it. John, tell me more about this production and what you thought of it.
I thought this was a good old-fashioned play about good old-fashioned politics. And both of those things seem to have expired in both Britain and America at about the same time. So it's a nice throwback to the 1960s. And I'm very surprised that it never had an airing in the UK until now. But that's possibly because Gore Vidal himself went in and out of favour, in and out of popularity quite a lot over that period of time. So yes, you're right. It's a satire. We are at the Philadelphia Democratic Convention, where in reality, John Kennedy beat Adlai Stevenson for the nomination in a kind of mood of optimism and newness and almost Blairite excitement that finally we were getting, or sorry, America was getting, a politician who was young enough to identify with, rather than the father figures, if you like, that had been presidents ever before. So each of Vidal's imaginary contenders are quite crudely different, if you like. Martin Shaw plays something I think is not too far from his television personalities: patrician, slightly boring, confident but not really letting it out front runner, who turns out secretly to be quite a womanizer in the Kennedy mold, perhaps, versus Jeff Fahey's, I think, overacted, angrier, younger slugger. He's like a boxer. He's like a fighter, a cage fighter or something, who just wants to come out and thump somebody. And he's got all that tension built up in him, whereas Shaw appears to be, you know, extremely relaxed. But the beautiful thing about it, and the thing that carries you forward, is that each of them reveals to his sidekick, because they each have like a political advisor, very well done, particularly Philip Cumbus as Martin Shaw's political advisor. They confide to their sidekick that each of them has a prime piece of dirt to smear on the opponent. And the race isn't really a race to win the nomination by popular vote. It's the race to see which of them will use this to damage his opponent's chances. Political comedy has evolved incredibly since 1960, and we are very used to the crispness and the sharpness and the wit of The West Wing and House of Cards. So you might think that this will just feel stale and dated, but I found there was a lot of charm in watching The Best Man, because it has a plot every bit as vicious as House of Cards, but it unfolds at a gentler pace. And there are some really, so many them off the telly cameo performances worthwhile enjoying. So you've got Sean Fahey up the front, of course, but Jack Shepherd plays a doddery ex-president that you think is going to be an absolute buffoon, but in fact he's still wanting to be the kingmaker. And he's so wonderfully two-faced and duplicitous and clever at the way he plays one of them off against the other without revealing which of them is going to get his endorsement. But what happens to him in the second act is a bit of a comeuppance. And I'm sure Gemma Jones did a good job as well, but I can now not think of anybody but Maureen Lipman to play this sardonic campaign veteran who holds the women's vote in her tightly clasped handbag. Lipman, she is, of course, an original actress, but if her characterisation reminded me of anything, and really accurately of the period, it's Mildred Natwick playing Jane Fonda's mother in Barefoot in the Park. And I thought she contributed something extra to the scenes she appears in. And I think there are only three, and it's a disappointment that she isn't threaded more thoroughly through the plot. The candidates' partners are very different. Glynis Barber, playing Martin Shaw's wife, is a woman on the brink of divorce. They are considering whether or not just to stay together for the sake of the children, but to stay together for the sake of the country, because a divorced or divorcing president wouldn't appeal, especially to that women's vote. And I thought Glynis Barber was just gorgeous. I thought she had the look and the attitude and the mannerisms and the subtlety of her own thoughts behind her public performance. Really beautifully nailed. It could be that Jeff Foley's wife, played by Honeysuckle Weeks, is less well written. I mean, both the wives are not very well written, but I thought Glynis Barber made much more of it. And I found her sort of clumsy Texan, sort of Jerry Hallish blonde, who perhaps is meant to have some of the characteristics of Jackie Bouvier Kennedy Onassis, would have given her more clues, really, of how to do it. But I did enjoy it. There are some cracking lines. They come with intermissions. You know, you won't get a laugh every third line. This isn't a television sitcom. But there are some extra degrees of wryness, if you like, given that we now know what has later occupied the White House. And I don't just mean the current one. I mean idiots like George W. Bush and philanderers like Clinton. So they're a marvellous layer of mirth for anyone who follows all that sort of politics. And Maureen Littman's character has a line that says, "Don't be too smart. Have an inoffensive wife and don't ever get into an argument about your mental health." Well, for me, that was the line of the night. There are several others like that. So I do think it's worth a watch. It's around till the middle of May. I think there are lots of discounts because it's a big theatre and not a mainstream ticket. But, well, it was well worth it for me. No startling new lights on the political machinations of the United States, but it's very good about smear campaigns, and it has a pretty sharp ending as well, so it is worth staying.
I was quite impressed by this. I mean, of course, it is a very detective-heavy play from the television point of view. I think pretty much many of the characters have either run their own detective series or have been in them. I mean, that's just a television thing, so it's not that important. And it wasn't really relevant to the play, but I think that's an attraction, and they are kind of pushing it a little bit in trying to get people interested in this play. One of the things, going back over looking at some of the past productions in America, this does seem to be rather a popular play. I mean, they revived it in 2001, and it got quite a lot of attention then, and won an Obie Award or something. And then they revived it in 2012 with James Earl Jones playing the old president, which was a rather an interesting idea at the time. But it does seem to work. I think one of the things I would like to have seen more is a slightly better feeling of the 1960s. I mean, obviously there are a lot of parallels to now, and there are a lot of parallels to the way that you can look at politics now. But part of me just wanted a kind of more 60s feel. And as you say, I don't want to hound out Honeysuckle Weeks or anything. But yes, I mean, I would have preferred a slightly more Jackie-like performance from her. Perhaps it's not written quite like that. You know, she is a bit of a ditz. Well, she comes across as a bit of a ditz, but she obviously is very manipulative underneath. I mean, that's one of this sort of very manipulative steel underneath, and this refusal to allow the dirt to come out about her husband.
She could have been Nancy Reagan with it, if you like, if you're looking for a wife that had to defend her husband's completely unacceptable acts. Well, or Hillary Clinton, really, before she took up the reins herself when she was in denial about Monica Lewinsky and his other affairs.
I think I kind of wanted, when I was watching it to be sort of more, remind me slightly more of the 1960s. But of course, most people aren't going to get that, and they are going to get all the modern parallels and feel for those. So it's just me being rather more interested in that aspect of the history of it. I mean, of course, in the original, Adlai Stevenson only got about 7% of the vote in the 1960 convention. He was way behind Johnson, who was LBJ. Yeah. Yeah.
And he had three goes at it, hadn't he? This was his third and final attempt to be nominated. I think what happened at the, well, numerically what happened at the Democratic convention is well represented by what happens in the final vote from the floor of the convention in this piece. But of course, we can't really talk about that, because it really does give the plot away.
Yeah, I did enjoy this play for what it was, and it is remarkable that this is almost 60 years old now and still packs a punch, manages to pack a bit of a punch and still be relevant. I mean, it is a well-made play in that old sense. And these days you might want a bit more spark in the dialogue and, you know, everything to be a bit more snappy. But I thought it worked really rather well when I saw it. Yeah. And for a very good night out. And yeah, obviously you can get plenty of discounts for it. So it's well worth seeing. We're now going to talk about Brief Encounter, which is being performed at the Empire Cinema in the Haymarket. We should point this out because there's also the famous Empire Leicester Square, and it's not that one. It is the Haymarket Theatre. It's gone under several different names. Now, Brief Encounter as a play was at the cinema some years ago when they first did it. This is an adaptation of Noel Coward's play by Nihai. It's been adapted by Emma Rice, who's also directing it. The designer is Neil Murray, with lighting by Malcolm Ripoff. It is an imaginative retelling of the Noel Coward film, which was also based on a short play, one of his Tonight at 8:30 plays, but it expanded for the film. Now, Emma Rice has apparently tweaked it since it was last in the West End, but hopefully has produced as much magic as she did before, because this is one of the things that made us really happy that she was going to go into the Shakespeare's Globe before she got into the Shakespeare's Globe and showed us that she didn't really like Shakespeare. This kind of this adaptation really worked and was extremely impressive. Now, John, tell me more about this particular production, what you thought of it.
Well, I sat behind Emma Rice at this press production, and I would say that everybody in that cinema wanted to hug her at the end, because if she has a trademark, it is to take a near sacred text and cut it up with her big scissors and put it back together again in a way that makes you love it afresh. Now, a lot of people will be very defensive about Shakespeare, and are very defensive, perhaps, if they're old enough and loyal enough, about Noel Coward. But I think even the master would have liked this one. There's a very interesting programme. I encourage people to buy, I don't often say buy the programme, but there's quite a lot of interesting narrative and essay in the programme about why she did what she did to it. So just to explain what it is a version of the movie in which some of it is projected onto a front cloth, but the cloth has slits in it so that people can step in and out of it, and you then get live action of the same characters doing the same scenes, but live for you. And it is a famous three hanky weepy of a movie, but what she has applied to it is a lot of Noel Coward's songs, which were not in the film and which have been very, very cleverly positioned and rewritten or musically rearranged for this piece. And I think that the music is different from, is it 8, 10 years ago that it was done before? 10 years ago. And so is some of the script. But just to talk for a minute about what's written in the programme, I've known for a while that Edward Albee wanted Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf to actually be a quartet for four gay men, because the bickering and the bantering really suits an older and a younger gay couple. And I've often pondered how Noel Coward's private lives would work if all the four partners were also male. And I really hope someone stages this sometime soon. But until seeing this refreshed version of Emma Rice's Brief Encounter and reading the programme notes, I've not considered what she says in it, that the illicit affair of Laura and Alec, who were played by Celia Johnson and Trevor Howard in the 1945 film, might be code for forbidden gay love. So different is the morality of 1938, when the play is set, from today's, that you could say it's a perfectly valid suggestion that Noel Coward might, in portraying two people so trapped inside the social conventions they have to occupy, that they're unable to act on and acknowledge the love they share, and that he could be identifying the problems of gay men at the time. Because this is also the same period as Quentin Crisp was writing about, when he was reflecting his own younger experiences as a gay man before the Second World War in The Naked Civil Servant. Now, I did Noel Coward for my degree dissertation, so I don't think I completely subscribe to Emma Rice's theory. And I think it's far more likely that Coward, who was trapped between his own personal horror of buggery, which limited his sexual activities, and the sort of increasingly fawning attention of London elites, and he rather enjoyed being in royal company and society and so on, I think he would not have been so bold as to do this deliberately. But it is an added layer of amusement to apply to what I think is a really bold and enjoyable staging of the classic film. So what Rice has done is she's opened the story out. The story, the three hanky weepy at the centre of Brief Encounter, is just housewife meets doctor in the railway station. She has a little bit of grit in her eye. He gets it out, and then they coincidentally meet again, and they start to spend their Thursday afternoons in the cinema and in the cafe and just kind of romancing each other without anything very physical happening until the Doctor gets an opportunity to take Laura to the apartment of a rather starchy friend of his. So that's still there, and it's very well delivered by Isabel Pollan and Jim Sturgeon as the central characters. But what Rice has done is opened it out and grafted onto it a sort of railway station romp. In that kind of, was it called Oh, Mr. Beeching? There was a sitcom using the characters from Heidi High. After Heidi High finished, they transplanted them into a railway station and they were the larger-than-life characters. And I think Rice might have been inspired by this because you've now got, as I say, a railway station romp in which the characters are exaggerated to cartoonish effect, but they are played by really, really competent, serious actors. And so you've got Beverly Rudd playing an absolute gawp of a tea room waitress, overseen by Lucy Thackeray, who is this very starched apron, very proper canteen manageress who secretly wants to be a real femme fatale and have a torrid affair with the station master. And then there's the music. So one of the characters is played by actor-musician Joss Slovik. He plays Rudd's anxious boyfriend, Stanley, and he's really deliciously awkward. You know, he's an absolute geek and shy, and she really has to encourage him to even put his hand on her knee. But then you contrast this with his sophistication and musicianship, singing so many of the Noel Coward numbers, which have been, I think, really seductively rearranged. Like Go Slow Johnny has been taken down to a slow, bluesy tempo, and it just earns new meaning and new delight. And this is all done by Nehi's long-served collaborator, Stu Barker. Isabel Pollan, I didn't really know her work, but I thought she was delightful as Laura and showed Laura's many moods beautifully. And you know the bit at the end of the film when she comes home at the end and there's a very sweet scene between her and the husband, but then she opens the piano and she mimes playing the music, which is the climax of the film. And I mean, for a minute, I thought, oh my God, this is absolutely incredible. Emma Rice has not only found a really talented actress who can deliver the Celia Johnson part, but she's found one that can play Rachmaninoff's second piano concerto as well. Well, it turns out to be miming, but just for a minute, you know, that we're thinking what a tremendous coup de théâtre that would have been. So, as I say, it's mostly live action, but there's plenty of interactive movie footage, and that's very well done. Gosh, you know, if you're the kind of boyhood enthusiast who likes steam trains, you'll be completely satisfied by this because there are plenty of them. And they do the breaking waves motif very cleverly. It is a pity that licensing means that they weren't able to intercut some of the actual David Lean film, because I think that is still an undeniable classic. But, you know, now it's had this refreshment, you would call it, wouldn't you? Because it's set in a railway station cafe. I think in its own way, this production's a bit of a classic too. And I'm sure it will have long life.
Gareth?
Well, I'm very positive about it as well. I mean, I did see the original production. I can't imagine I got much to add to it, really. I saw it last night and I thought she's improved it, to be honest. I actually think it was a better piece of work than the original piece of work. But I think what's interesting about it is that it, for me, it illustrated, you know, why she is a great director and why she should stick to what she's great at. In recent years, you know, we've had Four Lovers and 946 and this and four or five. Oh, and Romantics Anonymous, of course, you know, which is exactly what Emma Rice is for, really. And to me, it reinforces why she should continue as a director and not get involved in running bloody theatre companies.
You can find us at AYULTP on Twitter, on the Azeta named London Theatre Podcast page on Facebook, on the web we are AYULTP.com. The podcast can also be found on both iTunes and Stitcher, where you can leave a review. Thank you, goodbye.